The Pat Kenny Show
with Timber Living Log Cabins.
Saturday and Sunday from 10 a.m. on News Talk. Conversation that counts.
Well, we're going to go through the Sunday newspapers first with Mark Hennessy, who's Ireland and Britain editor with the Irish Times. Looking at the Irish Mail, first of all, Munster legend used his charity to pay own firm. This is a story about Doug Howlett. The secret of looking good at 93 years of age. Joan Collins is the one sharing her secret. Upskill plans for 100,000 workers in AI shakeup. And that is to persuade people, forget about your white collar degree, go get a trade. The Business Post exclusive, McDonald feels the heat as Sinn Féin slumps 4 points, and we'll dissect that poll in a few minutes' time. Also, Lucinda Creighton is talking about the left's folly on occupied territories bill is exposed, and more stories around that in many of the papers. I'm Irish, ousted BP boss Manifold defends his colourful language on the basis that he's Irish. How strange. Anyway, that's on the front of the Sunday Times. Toxic culture hampered patient care. It's a story about St. Vincent's Hospital, which was seems to be unique to the Sunday Times. Civil servant faces accusations of leaking data to Foreign Intelligence Service. That's one also in the Times. The Sunday Independent, Cairns rules out formal left-wing pact for the next election. That's their main story there. Looking at some of the red tops, the Irish Sunday Mirror, first degree murder. Wife killer Joe, and this is about Joe O'Reilly, gets university qualification behind bars, and shamed hurler DJ Carey also goes back to school in jail. And then the Irish Sun on Sunday has a story, Keelty's late, late clash. Patrick Keelty battles with RTE over telly format. It appears he wants to go back to its origins and be tougher. That's what Patrick has in mind. Now, Mark, you've been going through the papers. It's a bank holiday weekend selection, really, isn't it?
It is, and it has a certain flavour of that. I must say, I find most poll stories 3 years out from elections to be pretty meaningless. But I think the one that the Sunday Business Post today has on the state of the parties is particularly interesting in the wake of what we saw with the by-elections. And there's a lot of really bad news in it for Sinn Féin and the way in which it's getting crimped in a very different way to the problems it's
even
had.
Even though the numbers, and last time we read polls, people were saying, but Sinn Féin still were the biggest party. So,
yeah, no,
you know, it's not fair to them to be criticising.
No, and that is true. But
it's given the direction of travel, though.
It's the direction of travel. But more importantly, it's the kind of fracturing that's taking place, that once upon a time their target was to assault on Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, whereas now they're getting bitten away on the other side with the Sock Dems and with others. And we've seen in some of the papers today with the interviews with Holly Cairns ruling out formal left alliances. That's all the sort of things that a political leader can say when they think that they have the wind behind them. And we saw in the by-elections that the talk of left alliances and transfer pacts and all of that kind of thing didn't quite mean as much as perhaps some of the people would have hoped at the time. But Sinn Féin has had to reinvent itself a couple of times in the past and has done so successfully. A question now is whether it gets into some sort of internal debate. I was at their Ardèche in Belfast a few weeks ago, and I didn't get that sense that there was a real conversation going on about, you know, definitely people were unhappy. But in terms of people having solutions to the problems that they're facing, that's the answers to that seem to be far more vague.
Does Micheál Martin get any comfort, cold or otherwise, from this poll?
No, he doesn't. I mean, he's down, Fianna Fáil are down 1%, and his figures are poor. He's at a 36 rating. Now, as somebody said to me recently, or the other day, when they met him at something, and they described him as being giddy. And he's in that sort of frame of mind at the moment where he's going through to the presidency starting, and EU presidency starting July 1. There's no practical, credible way in which he's going to be removed between now and Christmas, unless something extraordinary happens or he decides to bolt himself, neither of which appear likely. That leaves us in a situation then where that has to happen in the early part of the next year, so that a Fianna Fáil or a replacement can become Taoiseach before the changeover in the coalition happens. And that leaves us in a situation, firstly, with the year of the three Taoiseach.
Yeah.
You don't run government buildings if you you have three different or two different people in three different slots in the course of 12 months. That's a disaster from the point of view of the coalition. But there's no obvious solution to it. And it's clear talking to backbenchers, they're not, Fianna Fáil backbenchers, they're not going to go up the hill again unless they think there's a Fianna Fáil challenger, a senior minister who's prepared to do the hard work, because they feel that they've been left in no man's land and hung out to dry.
What did you make of the Jim O'Callaghan story? I mean, he's seen as a pretender to the Fianna Fáil throne. What did you make of that? This is about, quote-unquote, a slush fund.
Yes, it is, the Chinese investment fund. I'm slightly confused by the story because I'm not entirely sure what the money pot is. That visa scheme was stopped in 2019. And now, unless there's a fund of money that was left there in 2019 and is ready to be used, it would seem at first glance that the announcements that were being made during the week by people supportive on Jim O'Callaghan on his behalf, announcing money for Kerry Football Club and stuff like that, that seems to be saying that they then have to go and find an investor who is prepared to put that money
forward.
But
if the scheme is closed, it's closed. And I mean, it was closed very rapidly, literally overnight, by Simon Harris.
It was. And in the face of mounting concern about the way in which it was being used by Chinese investors trying to do each-way bets on life in China and whether they would end up being at the receiving end of punishment from Xi Jinping and all of that kind of stuff. So there are things about that story I don't quite understand, I must confess.
Yeah, because if every money that is given to these things is linked to a project and to a passport or a...
Well, it has always had to be linked to a passport and project, but how does that happen with a fund that's suspended?
Yeah. I mean, how does the government get money out of that? That's what I'm concerned about, because if it's linked to a project, the government doesn't get any money.
No,
they supplied the visa, but they don't actually get the cash.
But
that cash goes to a charity or to a nursing home build or whatever it might be.
But that was always the case with this scheme.
Yeah.
That money never went into central exchequer. It went to particular projects, and by displaying your good faith as an investor in Project A, B, or
C. So what money is Jim O'Callaghan using?
Well, this is the point.
And the answer is, we do not know. Just one story I noticed in passing, that the Galway Ring Road has reached another stumbling block. A judicial review is launched. The endless saga of the Galway Ring.
Yeah, I mean, this is a couple who are deeply affected by it, because as I understand it, their house will disappear and they're understandably annoyed about that. So they're going to seek a judicial review, and presumably they won't be the last one. So, you know, Micheál Martin may want this road built, and an awful lot of people in Galway may want it built, but there's a long road in travel before we'll ever see a JCB.
Now, you were looking at the Champions League final last night, and of course it was too late for the papers to report, not on the result, which they do, but on what happened afterwards across France.
Well,
you know, riots and cars set on fire,
yeah,
which is kind of predictable in a way.
Well, unfortunately, given kind of summer heat waves and stuff like that, this kind of thing is becoming increasingly predictable. And there is definitely a situation with France with summer disturbances, particularly within the banlieue around Paris and places like that. So this is all going to become more and more problematic. It's almost kind of recreational violence for a certain type of person at this point.
Now, I think the sports fans, though, having watched that match, may be in despondency if they were fans of Arsenal, and it was a cliffhanger to the end. And you watched it, I watched it.
Yeah, well, I never thought Eze was going to score as I watched him running up to the ball, and I wouldn't claim to be an expert on football, but he didn't look like a man who was...
No, he was tentative.
He was tentative. And in fairness, I don't think Arsenal have any grounds for complaint, you know.
Yeah, well, when you take it to penalties, after that, it is a lottery.
No, it is, but, you know, frankly, they should have lost it within normal time. You know, I mean, when you've an 80-20.
However, the biggest story for football fans over the weekend, and yesterday I was listening to Off the Ball on News Talk here, and they thought they'd be talking about the Champions League. Instead, they were talking about Liverpool sacking Arne Slot. You know, and that was a shock.
Yeah.
Not a surprise.
Not a surprise, but a shock, and the manner in which it was done. And there seems to be an increasing brutality about the way in which these things are being done in football, you know, for that to happen in quite the way that it did. I mean, certainly, you know, his first year was a great success, but how much of that was on the back of Jurgen Klopp, we'll never know. You can argue the toss in it. But the second year has been a mess, and it's been a very divided camp. But, you know, do you have to sack a fella in quite the way that they did?
What do you make of the Sun on Sunday, Kielty's late, late clash? The idea that he's looking, before he signs a new contract, he's looking to toughen up the format, bring it back to its golden era.
Well, perhaps I should hesitate when I'm sitting beside somebody who once upon a time presented the programme, but I personally, I think he's right. I can't see what the future of the Late Late Show is with the current model with effectively C-list celebrities.
But don't forget, it is shorter. It's only a three-parter instead of a four-parter. Yeah, yeah. It's shorter in its seasonal duration. It's only, you know, less than 30 shows.
Yeah. No, he's got a much more difficult pitch, and he's got a much more fragmented media market. I mean, I think I was saying to you before the programme that the British TV figures on Thursday night, it was the first time ever when the five terrestrial stations in the UK had less than 1 million viewers each for their programmes at 9 p.m.
9 o'clock, which is the peak time.
Across the UK.
Less than 1 million each.
1 million each. 5 million out of 80 million people in the UK were watching traditional TV. So I don't see what future Keelty has or the show has, regardless of who's ahead of it, if they continue with the current model. I was at something last year or a few months ago in London, an Ireland Fund dinner in the Irish Embassy, and he did a fireside chat and he talked about, you know, growing up in Northern Ireland and his father and everything else, and it was absolutely riveting. There's a really intelligent, bright guy in there who I think could have a great opportunity to explore what's going on in Irish society in ways that we don't need rugby players coming in talking about their autobiography. I have no interest in watching that on a Friday night, and I don't think I'm alone.
The other thing is that I remember my former producer of The Late Late Show, the late Larry Masterson, he used to say, The Late Late Show has got to be like a good Irish dinner party. There's got to be some, you know, serious chat about politics, maybe a row, maybe someone walks out, someone might sing a song, there'll be good grub and a few drinks. That's the essence of what The Late Late Show should be.
It is, but it's, I mean, it's obviously a much tougher world now from the time.
That's the problem. Getting that big celeb to walk on, that big celeb has got to be in Dublin. And that's a harder call to make.
It is.
You know, try to get an agent to get their star to come over.
It isn't just about celebs. I mean, if you look at the
but it's part of it.
It is part of it, and I don't deny that it's part of it. But if you look at the kind of issues that are dominating conversation in every pub in Ireland, that could be brought into that kind of format with really interesting Irish people. If you look at the kind of people who are brought in front of microphones, you know, I'm one of them. It's a small enough pool of people in some ways. There's a way in which that pool could be vastly increased by a programme like The Late Late Show, and bring in, maybe kind of mix it almost with a certain element of questions and answers from years past, and create something that actually genuinely engages. I just don't see what future that programme has on a Friday night in an ever more fragmented market.
One of the intriguing stories in the papers, when there isn't much detail, such is the nature of the case, a civil servant accused of spying.
Yes, indeed. And I think that's, well, obviously, first of all, we have to be careful about what we say. But civil servant is working in a government department, Yevgen McKeefe. Originally.
And that's not an assumed name, a name changed by Deepol.
Yes. Originally from the UK, but with Irish
Ukraine.
Citizens. From Ukraine, I beg your pardon, but with Irish citizenship. And they appeared at Dublin District Court on Saturday after an investigation by the Garda Detectives Unit. And they were arrested at Dublin Airport. And we'll see how that case goes.
It's interesting that, you know, they waited, obviously, and we can't presume guilt or innocence until the trial proceeds. But when they were observing this individual, they clearly had him under some sort of surveillance. And then as he was about to depart the country on a one-way ticket, that's when they stopped him.
Yeah,
so presumably they were hoping it would lead to other information. But once he left the jurisdiction, that would become, be very difficult
that
to get
would
it back.
More manageable or more difficult. You'd have to assume that the element that actually accelerated this was the fact that it was a one-way ticket.
And the other story that is ongoing is that of the Jeffrey Donaldson case, which, you know, It's not easy reading, not easy listening.
No,
being described.
It's not. And again, the same rules apply. A person is innocent, etc., until proven otherwise. It's a case that's scheduled to last for 4 weeks. It's one that has had an almost seismic impact within long before it's got to trial, because it's taken so long to get to a hearing. It's had a seismic impact within unionism, and is going to have an ongoing set of reverberations throughout the union.
One of the disappointments for me in the papers is so little about Iran, the United States, what's going on in Lebanon at the moment, because I think the Sunday Times talks about Israel pushing more and more into Lebanon, and they understand this as a sign that Bibi fears a peace deal and he wants to get as much traction in Lebanon before Trump signs the deal.
Yes, and there's no doubt about that. And I think part of the decision to reoccupy large parts of Gaza will feed into that. And clearly, Trump isn't entirely in control of Netanyahu. Israel has its own interests that it will seek to protect and to advance in whatever way that it can. I think it's striking in terms of the way in which people are reading the story that you're dealing with people on both sides, on every side of this argument, where there's no longer any public trust in anything that any of these people say at any point. So if somebody says at 9 o'clock that there'll be a ceasefire at 6 o'clock in the morning, once upon a time you'd have had a certain degree of faith that might actually happen. Now we don't.
The only other humorous thing overnight came from Trump on a Truth Social post. It's not in the papers, obviously, but he was saying that all these artists who've turned him down for his big celebrations of 250 years of the United States, he's going to replace them with the acme of all talent, himself.
Yeah.
He's going to be the star of his own show in the absence of all the music.
You know, I mean, this is an ego that's completely out of control. But if you look at the midterms, 180 of the people who have got a Republican nomination to run have had Trump support. And so far, nobody who has not had Trump support has got a nomination. So even if there are issues within the broad mass of American opinion that's beginning to turn against him or whatever, the candidates who are going forward for the Republican Party are solidly on his side, out of grounds of fear, I think, at this stage.
Rooted in fear.
Rather than anything to do with actual support.
Mark Hennessy, news editor for Ireland and Britain with the Irish Times. Mark, thank you very much for joining us.
The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Timber Living Log Cabins.